This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
The Keystone XL pipeline, off, on, now, off again. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio. A federal judge in Montana has blocked, for now, the Keystone XL pipeline, which would deliver oil from Canada to Nebraska and eventually the Gulf Coast. The Trump administration gave the $8 billion oil pipeline the go-ahead last year, overturning the Obama administration's decision to deny the pipeline a permit. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer is in Washington. Nancy, tell us about this latest twist.
Well, Judge Brian Morris says the pipeline project can't go forward until the Trump administration answers some big questions. The judge said Trump just reversed the Obama administration's decision on Keystone without showing enough of its work. The judge says the law on this requires, quote, a reasoned explanation. Also, the judge said the Trump administration has to consider the effects of current low oil prices on how viable Keystone would be, plus the effects of greenhouse gas emissions and potential oil spills.
So presumably a reasoned explanation wasn't given then. So what's Keystone's status now?
Well, TransCanada, the company building the pipeline, had hoped to start construction next year. TransCanada hasn't responded to my request for comment, but in the past it said it hasn't made a final decision on whether to continue with the Keystone XL pipeline project.
Thanks, Nancy. And let's do the numbers. The FTSE in London is down 0.8%. Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ futures are down in the 0.6% to 0.5% range, with the Dow future down 159 points. The 10-year Treasury yield is at 3.21%. China has been hosting a massive trade fair all this past week. It drew more than 3,000 companies from 172 countries. It's part of Chinese President Xi Jinping's goal to open China up to global markets and import more from abroad. Jennifer Peck went. She's Marketplace's China correspondent. She's in Shanghai. Good morning.
Hi, Sabri.
What does this expo look like?
It's a massive building shaped like a four-leaf clover, and there are thousands of exhibitors. This import expo focuses on things for Chinese consumers, like Hungarian cheese, a flying car from Slovakia. For Chinese businesses, they're looking at medical scanners from General Electric.
Are there deals coming out of this event?
Yeah, China Eastern Airlines reportedly signed $2 billion worth of deals with the likes of Honeywell, ExxonMobil, Rolls-Royce, Cargill, which is affected by Chinese tariffs in this U.S. trade dispute, is also expected to sign more than $2 billion in deals for grain, cotton, iron ore, and beef to China.
These are deals for foreign companies to sell stuff into China. It sounds like it must be a big success for them.
Well, not exactly, because a lot of these big firms already do business in China. So some of these deals would have happened even without the import expo. So this expo has been taken by U.S. firms as largely symbolic. Smaller companies, though, are happier because they don't usually have access to Chinese government officials and state firms who make up the bulk of the 150,000 buyers from China. But what this expo doesn't address is a key U.S. concern, that Chinese companies can operate relatively freely in the U.S., but American companies still cannot do the same in China.
Jennifer Peck, Marketplace's China correspondent in Shanghai, thank you so much.
Thanks, Sabri.
Europe has rules for its member countries on how much debt they can go into. Those member countries do not always follow them. Italy especially has run afoul of EU rules on deficit spending and is facing a budget deadline on Tuesday. For better or for worse, here in the U.S., we don't have a strict definition of too much debt, but our next guest says Europe's definition is basically made up. Matthew Klein is economics commentator at Barron's. Morning.
Thanks for having me.
Italy is proposing a deficit of 2.4%. Europe wants that number to be 0.8%. This seems to be a very minor difference that's resulted in a big diplomatic flare-up. Where did Europe get this definition for what's an acceptable deficit to begin with?
So the Europeans are thinking primarily about how to reduce Italy's debt because they think that Italy's government debt at 130% of GDP is too big. They came up with a definition about 30 years ago that debt should be 60%. That definition is not based on economic analysis. It's based on what was the average at the time in Western Europe.
The European Union does have a certain amount of flexibility to allow countries to go into a little more debt when they need to, because countries need to do that when they're in trouble and support their economies and they can pay it off later. But Europe doesn't actually believe that Italy is in trouble. Why is that?
So the reason is that the flexibility that they give is based on a mathematical calculation relating to inflation. And the problem is that this doesn't really work well for countries that have had severe depression. Italy's problem is that even though the economy is significantly smaller now than it was 10 years ago, the European Commission's data imply that Italy is actually fully recovered. And the Italian government disagrees with that assessment.
The fact that there are such divergent assessments between member countries and the EU as to how the individual economies of that bloc are doing does not bode well for a union that is trying to stick together. Is there any attempt to resolve these definitions that are so arbitrary?
In terms of the flexibility provided by the treaties, it seems like it's going to be very tricky because you have a large bloc of countries within Europe, particularly within Northern Europe, that has a view that government debt is a fundamentally destabilizing force in an economy and should be reduced as much as possible in all circumstances. That is a very extreme view. It's not what most normal economists would think is sort of the way governments should run their policy in sort of a default state. But that is effectively what has been baked into the treaties.
Matthew Klein, economics commentator for Barron's. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.